McLean Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. I have one thought that we need to begin the morning with. I think it's a thought that should stay with you. And that is, chiggers make it real. Let me say it again. Chiggers make it real. Oh, I don't know. You may disagree with that. You may call them red bugs. So we'll call it red bugs. Make it real. Right? I'm thinking about this last night. I'm scratching. And I guess there should be some context for it because it's really, really interesting. I was out. I'm actually out thinking about where I am. Once you start thinking about where you are, it'll blow your mind. You almost can't believe where you are. Now, how does it happen? How does it get started? It gets started. Get started in your garden. So I've been making these tomatoes lately, and they are so incredibly good. They are so good. And the peppers are so absolutely incredible. And the okra is just amazing. And I'm thinking, goodness gracious, I am eating so well. This is like, I can't go to a restaurant and get anything like this. This is wonderful. And people come and eat those tomatoes and they say, oh my goodness. I mean, they can't believe it. It's almost unreal. It's so good. It's absolutely fantastic. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's incredible. And the sunflowers are out there blooming, and the sunflowers have started, and I'm just looking at all these different sunflowers now. And I'm not talking about the Ukrainian sunflowers, which are beautiful and which I'm glad the Ukrainians have, and I'm glad they got them from the United States because that's where all sunflowers come from. But I'm looking at all the wild sunflowers growing in Alabama, and I'm realizing Alabama is the center of sunflower diversity. It's also the center of silphium diversity. Most people would have a hard time telling apart, but there's a big difference. And I'm thinking, God, what a spectacular show it is out here. It's unbelievable. How did we end up with so many? I mean, we got more than half the world's species, sunflower species, here in Alabama. We're the center of sunflower diversity. It's just amazing. Look, I was trying to explain to somebody why Alabama's important. And, you know, they got a life other than football. Most of us do. And football's fine. But, I had to come up with, and so I'm talking about all of the incredible things. And one of the things I said was, look, we got this little piece of stream out here that we've helped to preserve a few months ago. And I'm sitting there on the edge of this stream, sitting on the Paint Rock River. Could have been on the Cahaba River. Could have been on the Perdido River. Could have been on any number of places in Alabama. But this is one of the richer places. I'm realizing, man, you know, there are 100 species of fish in this little stream right in front of me. In 1 mile, I'm talking about 1 mile of stream, there are more species of fish in this river that we preserved here in Alabama than there are in the entire state of California. I think there are more species of fish in that one little 1 mile stream segment on the Paint Rock River, or on the Cahaba River, or on the Perdido River, or on the Alabama River, than there are in the entire Pacific Coast drainage from Mexico to Canada. Now, I'm not talking about one river equaling California now. I'm talking about one little segment of that river. Oh, it's just unreal. I can't believe it. It's unbelievable. I was, you know, we don't think about how many ways where we have this exceptional diversity that's not just exceptional here, but exceptional around the globe. Alabama, of all things, and I'm thinking about it. And look, here's this incredible thing. I realize that mussels, shellfish, mussels, Alabama was famous for its mussels. The greatest concentration of mussels in the world, where do you think that was? Ever recorded was in Mussel Shoals. We spelled it wrong in Alabama so that we wouldn't have to remember that we wiped a lot of those mussels out in Mussel Shoals with dams. But Alabama, the state, which is 1% of the 1% of the land area of the United States, Alabama, 1% of the land area of the United States, is the center of oak diversity. It's the center of hickory diversity globally. It's the center of magnolia diversity. It's the center of crawfish diversity in the world. It's unbelievable. 100 species or more of crawfish in Alabama. Certainly there will be more. The mussel diversity here, there is, so the tropics must be much better. The Amazon must be much better. Well, it is in some ways. But you know what? Crawfish diversity, mussel diversity, we're amazing. We've got more fish diversity in Alabama than all of Central America. All of the tropics, all of those tropics rivers in Central America, all of those countries, Alabama has more fish species. Is that not amazing? Mussel diversity in Alabama. We have more mussel diversity in Alabama than all of Central and South America combined. Amazon, Central America, everything. If you have any sense of what the globe's like, that's amazing. That is absolutely stunning. We have more species of mussels in Alabama than any country. Any country, China, Brazil, you name it, we have more species of mussels than any country in the world. Alabama, little old Alabama. It just boggles my mind. And I'm sitting on this beautiful river, and I'm enjoying it, and I'm looking at the grasses and thinking how beautiful. I'm thinking about the sunflowers, and I'm thinking about these great tomatoes that I'm going to have for supper, along with some great pesto. And you know what? I start itching. Because I'm in a dream. I think this is impossible. And somehow the chiggers make it all real again. Doesn't change it. Just makes you realize, yeah, this thing is real. This is a real place. This is a real thing. I got the itches to prove it. The chiggers are still here. The ticks are still here. Not as bad as they have been in some years, but they're still here. The annoyances are here, still here. But man, what an incredible place. What an incredible place. Well, I hope you get some chiggers today. Maybe not. I think it'll help to make it all real. But I do think you ought to be thinking about, gosh, what an incredible place it is. And then when you get so taken away, you get so overwhelmed with how incredible it is. If you want to come back to Earth, if you want to make it feel all real again and still have the dream in your head, just get some chiggers. They'll help. They always do. Hey, I've got some thoughts about chiggers too, about how to deal with them before and after you get them. We'll talk about it when I come back. We'll talk about what works and what doesn't, in case any of you ever have to deal with them. You know, if you're going to get into really beautiful places, you're always going to have to deal with chiggers. That's just life. That's life. But there's ways of dealing with it. We can learn about it. Hey, we got a lot to talk about this morning. Got a lot to talk about in your yard. Got a lot to talk about in this dreamy place called Alabama. Hope I can help you. You send me your photographs. You send me your texts. We'll try to answer them. We got a good 2 hours to do this. So you just get busy. 251-343-0106.
Me and my best friend Lillian in her blue tick hound dog Gideon, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio plays.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. So I said I was going to talk a little bit about chiggers. Let me do that. Red bugs, chiggers, is there a dividing line in the state? I don't know. That's one important question that we've never answered. Why do some people call them red bugs and why do some people call them chiggers? I don't know. And I can't find any regional pattern to it. If anybody knows a regional pattern, let me know. We should have a vote. I don't know how to conduct a vote. But, you know, if we could conduct a vote, we could have. How many of you call them red bugs and how many of them call chiggers? Same thing. They're little tiny mites. They're mites, actually. And they really, the adults, completely harmless. They live on trees and other things and don't bother you at all as adults. But the juveniles, in order to get that little extra vitamin boost to become healthy, productive adults, suck your skin. That's right. They actually, and I don't even think they suck blood. Somebody help me on this if you're a medical expert on chiggers. I don't think they suck blood. I think they actually suck juices from your upper layer of your skin, but they put their little proboscis in there, and they actually create a little hole, a little, oh, I don't know exactly how they do it, but it's a little thing, and it's a feeding cavity is the best way to do it. And the juices fill that, ooh, it's just, if you think about it, it's really, it'll make you itch just to think about it. So that's what they do. And they often get into little places, you know, they can get on your stomach. They'll get in your belly button. Ooh, boy. And you can imagine, given that, where else they can get. Oh, I don't want to talk about it anymore. But they'll get all over your ankles, everywhere else. What do you do about them? And, you know, it's some good things to do. I am often in the woods with people who wear short pants. Traditionally in the South, people did not wear short pants in the woods in summer. And you may think that's funny, but I want you to wear short pants out in summer in the woods where the chiggers are, and you won't think it's funny anymore. People wearing long pants. It helps to wear long pants. Also helps to tuck your pants into your socks. If you've got some boots, I actually have some boots, and I actually tuck the pants into the boots. That helps a lot. It's amazing how well that helps. And then you can spray around the collar of your boot, and you can prevent most of the chigger. That's all really good to know. It's really good to know. And then you got to worry about your waist, because they'll find their way in your waist if the grass is a little high. You got to worry about that. You can spray around your waist, and that's a little harder to deal with. Sulfur works pretty well. I think this works. Anybody who's been out there with chiggers can tell me, do you think sulfur makes a difference? I think it does. Cliff says, so Chigger X, I'm not sure what Chigger X does, whether it prevents or not, but let me talk to you about when you get the chiggers now. You ever done the sulfur thing? We should go back to that. Just a second. You ever done the sulfur thing? This was the old-fashioned way of dealing with chiggers, and I think it works really well. You do have to reapply it if you're getting really wet frequently, but that's pretty much true with any chigger repellent. But sulfur works pretty well. It comes in a little bag that usually has a little snake on it because of the myth that sulfur somehow stops snakes, which it doesn't do at all. But nonetheless, it makes people who are needlessly worried about snakes feel better. But you get that, and you put it in a little, we used to put it in hose. People wore hose. I don't know if anybody remembers that people used to wear hose all the time. I think people still do a little bit, but not as much as they used to. But you can put them in socks. You can put, just dump it in the socks, and then you got a little ball of sulfur there in the bottom of the socks, the bottom of the hose, and you just slap it around your ankles and around your waist. I think it works pretty well. But let me talk about what happens when chiggers attach. You know, it's usually already happened. It's a very simple thing. As soon as you can, and this works pretty well, get back to the house. All you got to do is soap up. There's a lot of expensive yakety yak out there, but soap is amazing. It is amazing against chiggers. Just go ahead and soap up, but don't let the water wash the soap off. Just stand there in the shower. You've soaped up pretty good. Let the soap linger there. That soap deteriorates the body of small insects really well. It really is very effective. And it will. And you can scrub it if you want. You can take a little brush and scrub if you like. But I think just the soap alone, let it sit there for just a little while. Turn the shower off. It's nice and hot now. You don't need to have the shower on all the time. Just leave it there. And then when you sat there 2 or 3 minutes, then you can wash it off. And it makes a big difference in the number of chigger bites you'll have, but you'll still have a few because chiggers make it real. You know, that's the way it is. That's the way it is. So that's my chigger lecture. The nail polish does nothing. Ooh, I'm going to be in so much trouble. Fingernail polish is completely useless. Does nothing. It's well documented now that fingernail polish, all it does is make you feel better because you think you've done something, but it does nothing. I think the soap works. I can guarantee you the fingernail polish doesn't. Chigger-X, after being infected, it may have Clorox would work. I can see that Clorox would work. But I don't like having Clorox on my skin. So I think soap works really well. Soap is going to work as well as Clorox would. And just leave the soap on long enough because it will, any ticks that are still moving around are going to be killed. Any ticks that are beginning to burrow in are going to be killed. It somehow seems to soothe the bites that have already occurred a little bit as well. But soap is probably good once you've had that. So there it is. I'm sticking by it. If you can try whatever. Coal and kerosene oil works. Yes, yes. And you know, nuclear radiation works. It all works. It's like using Dom Perignon champagne to get rid of the ants, except kind of in reverse. I don't think you need to use coal oil. It certainly would work. It will kill the chiggers. It will probably not be good for you. There's a lot of carcinogens in gas and coal tar that are not good for you, and you're going to smell like holy thunder. Now, fish sniper, you don't mind if you smell like kerosene, right? But some people might not want to smell like kerosene. Maybe they got to go to church, you know? Maybe they're going to a restaurant. There it is. There it is. So, chiggers. Chiggers makes it real. I knew we were going to get a lot of comments on that this morning. Is Alabama the center for chigger diversity? You know, that is very interesting. I don't know. I think we have more than one chigger species. I have not been able to get anybody to actually do the work on this. But my feeling is that we probably have multiple chigger species that haven't really been identified here. We'll see. And it's a curiosity. And it's really an interesting question. You know, in different parts of the state, you react to chiggers differently. So you can get used to chiggers in one place, and you may not even notice them, even though they're plugging in and sapping your skin, sucking your skin away. You may not even notice. You'll go to another place and you'll get chiggers, and man, they'll drive you crazy. It'll drive you crazy. Some people have more of a reaction to chigger bites than others. I generally have a big reaction to chigger bites, but I will tell you there's some chiggers that just, they don't bother me that much. And some that just do. So I suspect that means there may be more than one species out there. Are we the center of diversity? I don't know. There are, if you go to the Southeast Asia, I suspect there are more. And they have chiggers there that actually carry disease. Ours don't carry disease, which is kind of nice. I think that's nice. There it is. Chiggers. David, I hope that helped. Let's listen. Listen, I got a bunch of photographs. I got a bunch of pictures we're going to deal with. First off, I'm going to deal with, who sent me this? I got the picture last week. I'm not sure who it is, but it's a picture of a lime tree in a pot. And we talked about it last week. And we talked about increasing the size of the pot. You know, I think there's nothing at all wrong with plastic pots. There's nothing at all wrong with styrofoam pots. And in fact, I prefer styrofoam pots for a lot of reasons. They make some good big styrofoam pots that are pretty useful, and they're not that expensive, and you can get them in bigger sizes. And those styrofoam pots, if you're worried about actually breathing through the pots, the styrofoam is sort of open cell, and it's pretty easy. And the styrofoam doesn't look like styrofoam. It looks like a plastic pot, but it's made out of, I mean, it looks like a clay pot, but it's made out of a composite material. It's a composite resin material. There's all kinds of them. And I think they do breathe a little bit more than pure plastic. But here's the thing. It does not matter about breathing through the edges of the pot that much. Oxygen diffusion in a pot is pretty good as long as you don't overwater. So we're going to come back and talk about that in just a minute. Yeah, I think plastic pots are just fine. Grow on,
sweet potato vine. Have you ever seen peaches? Grow on, sweet potato vine.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back, Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. A lot of fun questions this morning, and many of them are pretty easy to deal with. We just need to think about them a little bit. So the picture of the was it a lemon tree in a container, potted up, increase the size of it, and don't feel like you have to use a clay pot. I moved away from clay pots. There's so many pots out there, resin pots, styrofoam pots, bigger pots. They don't even have to be super pretty. You could get a black pot and then get somebody you know, or you yourself can build a little wooden container to put around it, a little square wooden container, and just set that in that. That's kind of a nice thing to do, right? So plastic pots work fine. The drainage should be good in the bottom. And one of the things I do when I get plastic pots is to cut drainage holes in the side, right where the side, don't do it so that it destroys the integrity of the pot. Do it above the base. But put about four holes around the side. Just, you know, take a drill and drill it in. And that helps. But, you know, drainage is not so much about the container. It's more about the soil and about how you water. And with pots in containers, with plants in containers, what you have to remember is that water is always going to be slow to leave the bottom of the pot. There is no way to make a difference on that, other than to have plenty of oxygen in the soil mix itself. It's just always going to be slower at the bottom. Those extra drainage holes help maybe a little bit. just maybe a little bit with some extra water, but it's still going to be wetter at the bottom of the pot. So you want to use a really well-draining mixture throughout the pot. That and you know, that well-draining is not the right word. I hate to digress here, but let's talk about this, because we're talking about plants in containers. I bet a number of you put plants in containers on occasion. And this is really important. We use the term well-draining, and here I did it again, and I just said, oh, it's good. But, you know, that's not what we really want to talk about. What we really want to talk about is not soil that's well-draining, but soil that retains a lot of oxygen. Because there's space between those soil particles, right? And there's space, little tiny spaces on the soil particles themselves that hold on to both oxygen and water. Roots need both. They got to have both. And containers are pretty good about retaining oxygen because they're more exposed to the outside environment than your soil is in the ground. They got other problems, but at least they got plenty of exposure to oxygen. So the big thing is make sure that you use a soil mix that is coarse. And I'm just going to tell you, pine bark is the thing to use in your container. The mix you need to use here is pine bark. It's got to be 75% pine bark. Now, you can come up with, whatever your buddy in Minnesota or Arizona tells you on Facebook or whatever thing you're looking at, you got to realize you don't live in Minnesota and you don't live in Arizona. You live in Alabama, and it rains a lot here, a lot. There's no place in Alabama that gets less rain than Seattle. I mean, in fact, almost any place in Alabama is going to get twice as much rain, almost twice as much rain as the Seattle airport. I kid you not. We barely understand where we are. We get a lot of rain here. So our soil mix has to reflect that. And pine bark does it. Pine bark does it for two reasons. One, there's a lot of space between the particles. That allows water to occupy some of the space and oxygen to apply some of the space between particles. But actually within and on those particles, the pine bark retains a lot of oxygen. It has a good strong negative charge. It retains a lot of oxygen on those particles, along with drops of moisture. So the roots have both, and they gotta have both. So maybe we overemphasize drainage, and we put all that nonsense about putting gravel in the bottom of the pot does no good whatsoever. No good whatsoever. We can talk about, somebody call me and ask me why putting gravel in the bottom of a pot does no good. So don't do that. Doesn't help at all. So there it is. Use a good potting mix that's mostly pine bark. Oliver has some down at Shore Acres. I think it's a great mix. I highly recommend it. There are probably others out there, but Oliver's got a good one. And the last thing about that lemon, and you call me back if I haven't answered everything, is yes, you're worried about bugs eating it. Those are leaf miners, and they cause problems, and you're not going to be able to control them with anything you put on there because they're inside the leaf. But here's the good thing. They don't affect the plant. They have, and there's plenty of research on this, they have almost zero impact on the plant itself. None. Because the leaf is still there. It's still doing photosynthesis. It's still pretty good leaf surface. And it's a brief period of time when the leaf miners are a problem. You can't do much about them. You just kind of live with them. They do serve as entry points for disease, but mostly that's not going to be a concern here as long as we keep some of the worst away. But it's a citrus leaf miner. You just sort of say, oh, it's a citrus leaf miner. It'll pass. It's a chigger. Chiggers make it real. Citrus leaf miners make it real. But they don't hurt the citrus that much. So don't worry about them. You're good. All right. Bill, I'm listening. Tell me what's going on. You there?
Chiggers, too. But our real plague this year and the last couple of years has been ticks. I mean, dog ticks, little tiny ticks, every kind of tick. In fact, I have just been out in my backyard filling up my bird feeders, and we have found the only way to totally avoid them is I wear a hazmat suit when I'm out there. Because if you just wear boots or socks treated with pyrethrin, whatever, if you brush up against anything, I've got tall milkweeds, brush up against them, you still get ticks. So I have found the only way to totally avoid them is a hazmat suit. I was about burned up, about died from it. Heat stroke out there, wearing a hazmat suit at times, but that's the only way to avoid them.
Yeah, so here it is. It's very interesting, isn't it? And we have, I am in habitats with ticks all the time and chiggers. The chiggers we talked about a little bit, but you know, it's a very interesting thing in Alabama. We avoiding, it's like sort of like avoiding mosquitoes, avoiding ticks. It's hard to do. Ticks make it real as well. I do think we have more ticks than usual. One of the than we used to have, and there are many reasons for that. There are many ways to reduce the number of ticks in the environment, or there's one great way, which is to burn. Really, really effective. And we could talk more about that at another time, because you're probably not going to be able to do that in your yard. But here's some thoughts about ticks. We don't have Lyme disease in Alabama. Oh, boy, I shouldn't have said that out loud. Oh, my goodness, am I going to get in trouble? I can't say it, because I'll get all kind of – but here's the thing. We do have – and this is really important to understand. And it's important not because it should make you feel better, but because it should make you think a little bit more carefully about what you're doing. We probably also rarely have Rocky Mountain spotted tick fever in Alabama. And there have been lots of assessments by CDC and other people demonstrating that we don't have those two diseases. What we do have are other diseases that may be better or may be worse. We're not sure yet, because we here in Alabama get all of our information from Minnesota and Boston. And so we think that if Boston knows everything, and we're going to get all of our, because we don't think we have a mind down here to do studies on our own. If we were doing studies on our own and reading about what was happening in Alabama, we would recognize that there are diseases like southern tick-related illness, the southern tick-related rash, tick-associated rash illness, STARI. Sorry, had to get all those things. Which resembles Lyme, but which is, in fact, is not nearly as serious. And there are other diseases, too, that we can pick up here. Like there is a Rocky Mountain spotted tick fever-like disease that's Rickettsia parkeri, which I probably had. In fact, I probably got it. It was diagnosed as Rocky Mountain spotted tick fever, but more than likely it was parkeri. We know very little about these diseases. We think they're less severe. We think they're less severe than a lot of the diseases we're seeing in the rest of the country. So we don't get Powhatan, or however you pronounce that virus down here, because we don't have the ticks that carry it, and we don't have that endemic population of ticks. So. It's kind of a nice way to think about it. I would say here's what I always tell people, because we have lots of interns out and they're out in the woods getting ticks all the time. You don't want to have ticks stay on you for more than 24 hours. And so just when you get home, just pull them off and look for them religiously, and you're probably not going to get any diseases. I have had hundreds of ticks on me, and one, which I failed to take off 15 years ago, shared a disease with me, which I took doxycycline for and got over very quickly. So don't be too afraid of ticks. Just take them off.
We have some Bill, that are so tiny, you cannot see them. You're not aware of them until they dig in, and then they itch so intensely, you can't ignore them. But if they didn't itch, you would never know they were there.
Yes, and that's the great part about Lone Star ticks, which are mostly what we have in much of Alabama. We have others, but Lone Star is the big one. Lone Star itches like crazy. And so it's usually pretty easy to find them. When you feel that itch, just get a mirror and pick them off. Get a good pair of tweezers.
Chicken make no yell, possums twirl, that's all empty and I don't care.
Saw my baby down by the river,
knew she'd have to come up soon for care.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, got to get the dogs out of the house. Sorry about that. Didn't mean for them to be in here. We've got a bunch of photographs we're going to deal with this morning of various things. We've got some small bugs on the lima beans from Bruce. And they do smell. They smell like grape bubble gum, do they not? Is that not right? I mean, it's grape. It's a definitely grape odor, but it's not, it's kind of an artificial grape odor. And it's got a little bit of stink behind it, too, which is why, but there it is. And it's a very interesting bug. It's trapezoidal. It's weird looking bug, right? Because it's not round. It's looks like a weird square with different sides on it. And so it's a kudzu bug. It's a bug we introduced a while back. It probably has an impact on the kudzu, we think, but it also has an impact on your lima beans. And it's just yet another problem we have. Kudzu bug. Is it a problem? I don't know. They don't prefer beans. They don't prefer our garden beans, but they will use our garden beans if they can't find enough kudzu. Kudzu is their preferred host. I have heard that they were a big problem in soybeans. I'm not sure that they are, but there was some concern that they would be. I think it's a good idea to collect them. Which you probably can, because they're not going to be there in huge numbers because it's not a preferred host. But I would collect them, kudzu bugs, as they get on your limas. I haven't seen them that much on other things. Kudzu bug, there they are. You can look them up. Read all about them. Fish sniper, and I was not fair to Fish Sniper because he had a pretty good idea. So the coal oil, kerosene, would be put on a cloth and wrapped around your ankles. It's still going to make you smell pretty bad. And Fish Sniper should have countered to me, yeah, well, so does sulfur. Yes, there's no question. But I don't think sulfur is going to stick with you quite the way kerosene does. Kerosene has an odor that, I mean, it's going to follow you right to church. It's going to follow you right into the restaurant. Even it's hard to wash off, but there it is. And if you're desperate, I think Fish Sniper's right. Kerosene soaked in a cloth can work real well. And that's what you would do if you needed to do it. And Fish Sniper came back with another question. Do pineapples have seeds? And that's a really interesting question. And do bananas have seeds? You can see where the seeds were in the bananas when you eat them. And if you grow an ornamental banana, you'll see the seeds, which are quite large. Pineapples, bananas, and a lot of other fruits we've developed and selected for over the years so that, in essence, they're not really producing seeds anymore. And that can be a problem. it can be an issue. But most pineapples are started vegetatively, not by seeds anymore, so that we're sure we get exactly something exactly like the parent. But no, you're not going to be able to save the seed from your pineapple. It's a fruit gone wrong, if you will. From a pineapple's evolutionary perspective, it's a quirk. It's a dead end. It is the demise of that pineapple to have a fruit like that. But it's a distorted fruit that is actually quite good to eat. And that's what we selected for. So from your standpoint, and I'm not entirely sure how it's all done in the tropics, but from your standpoint, what you'd have to do is you want to cut the top of that pineapple off, of the pineapple that you ate, cut it off and let that top root, because it does that very well. Let's see here. What else we got? There was a couple of other good questions. Johnny. Johnny, the grass that you have in your St. Augustine is, Johnny's down in Grand Bay, and is Opilus manus. It's basket grass. And it's a native grass. It's not an aggressive grass. It doesn't compete well with other things. And so it tends to come in. Here's where I always see basket grass. Where it's too shady for the St. Augustine, or where the St. Augustine has been worn down, and particularly in areas where both have happened, because the St. Augustine isn't there anymore, and because it's too shady for the St. Augustine, the basket grass, Opilus manus, which doesn't compete well with other things, finds that bare ground and gets a root and then covers that bare ground. So, yes, you can get rid of the Opilus manus. You can get rid of the basket grass. But then you got to figure out, oh, what am I going to put there? So, Johnny, my bet is, and you, Johnny, you call me and tell me I'm screwy if this ain't right. I think that's in a shady area, or a wet, or maybe a very wet area, or a well-trafficked area where the St. Augustine isn't doing well. So if you care about it, if it makes a big difference to you, and I'm not saying you have to get rid of it. In fact, a lot of people use Opilus manus. Basket grass is actually an ornamental and used as a ground cover in many places. It won't be there all winter, but it makes a nice summer ground cover. It's very, very attractive in a way. But if you don't want it there, you're going to have to figure out how to get your St. Augustine to grow there. So we got to figure out, why is the St. Augustine not growing in that spot? And it looks a bit wet. It looks a bit maybe shady as well. I don't have the whole picture in front of me, but you can help me there. And Johnny also said he cut his azaleas down to 18 inches. 10-foot tall azaleas, and should I take them to the ground? 18 inches is probably fine. There is a trunk funk that gets on those azaleas, and you actually want to get it as low as you can to get rid of that trunk funk about every 15 years, and so that it doesn't get down into the crown. If you're not seeing any of the trunk funk, if you're not seeing any of the diseases on those stems that you've cut back to 18 inches, then you probably don't need to cut it any lower. If you see any disease on those stems you've cut back to 18 inches, any remaining wounds or lesions or any kind of little bad-looking ugly parts on there, maybe you want to cut it back a little bit farther. Johnny, I will say that it's a good experiment. I generally recommend cutting them back in spring. I wouldn't cut it back anymore at this point. There's a lot of hazards that can occur cutting it back this late in the year. So don't cut it back anymore right now. If you do see lesions on there, cut it back in spring. Finish cutting it back in spring, and cut it back to where you to below any kind of lesions or diseases or anything else you see around the trunk. And in general, when I say for people to cut their azaleas back, I do think it's a good idea to cut them back to about to 12 inches or less. That's probably fair. That's probably good. That's probably going to contain most of the problems. And then you'll see lots of sprouts coming up from the base, and you'll be just fine. 18 inches, you're going to get probably not as much growth from the base, which is where you'd prefer to have most of it. You'll get a lot, but probably not as much as you'd like from the base. But 12 inches, you'll get plenty of growth from the base. Johnny, does that help? Hope so. So we're going to have to take a break here, a big break for the top of the hour. We're going to make sure that all of our dogs are in the right place, and that Fish Sniper smells good enough to go to church. Hey, we're going to be back.
Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, here we go. So we had a lot of we hit a lot of things today. We were talking about ticks. We've been talking about, which let's save the ticks for another day. If you've got some big questions, we need to reserve a show for ticks. I felt like chiggers have, you know, chiggers deserve their own show. Right? We got all kind of advice about chiggers. And we're happy to reiterate that and talk about it. And the idea was chiggers make it real. And in this dream world that we live in Alabama, you have no idea how important it is to the rest of the world. You know, this is the dilemma in Alabama. And this is the dilemma I face. I could say, oh, well, it doesn't matter that we're destroying Alabama. It's just, you know, Alabama will have to live with it. But here's the problem. What happens in Alabama because of this great diversity of everything matters to the rest of the country and matters to the world. And so when we lose Alabama, the world loses options. North America loses options in a huge way, because much of the genetics that will allow the United States to survive continuing climate change and other changes are here in Alabama. Remind me to talk about elms sometime. Somebody could ask me to talk about why are elms living in Alabama? Why are there so many elms in Alabama? Weren't they all supposed to be wiped out by Dutch elm disease? Because we all know, because we got our information from Boston, and Boston said all the elms got wiped out by Dutch elm disease. Surely Boston's right. Why are there so many elms in Alabama? Why are there so many native... Does anybody... This is important. It's important. Now, I'm going to say this too, and then we're going to get back to chiggers, because chiggers make it real. It's not just that we have an obligation to the rest of the world. It's that, you know, you're always, what's in it for me, buddy? What's in it for me? Well, I'll tell you. I think one of the great exports, I'm using that word very choosedly, one of the great exports of Alabama has always been its biodiversity, has always been its diversity of plants and animals. They are hugely important. We are actually now taking mussels from Alabama. And we have a whole center dedicated to doing this in central Alabama. We're taking those mussels from Alabama and we're reintroducing them to the rest of the country where they've been lost. That's an industry. It's got employees. It's a major, it's a significant employer in the Black Belt. It's an industry. And we haven't even begun to think about how important that is. I'm actually working on doing that myself. I'm not going to make any money on it. I want other people to make money on it. But we're actually doing that with shortleaf pine and a lot of other plants from Alabama. That's what our research center is all about in the places we're developing in the state, is to make sure we can export Alabama's biodiversity, and we can do it in a way that is beneficial economically to Alabama. It's an important thing. It's our great export. It's all pretty heady. It's just gonna be way more than you maybe have ever thought about before, but it's what we need to be thinking about because it's something we have that's really incredible that we can be sharing with the rest of the world. Even the knowledge of how these species work is important to share with the rest of the world. And if anybody asks me about elms, I'll tell you how that works. It's pretty cool. It's pretty neat. It's pretty wild. It's incredible. So we'll talk about that sometime. Meanwhile, just so that you don't get vertigo thinking about all this, I'm going to remind you, we have chiggers, and chiggers make it real. Boy, do they make it real. Whew. But that's good. Ellen, so the tomatoes, I'm going to tell you, Ellen, I tried a lot of tomatoes this year. I tried a lot of tomatoes, and they were all pretty good. But the tomatoes that people keep talking about, and I could go on a big list, but the tomatoes that people keep talking about consistently, Jarrett knows this. Jarrett's been enthusiastic about it, at least with, is Puerto Cortez, P-U-E-R-T-O, Puerto Port, I guess. Puerto Cortez. Which I got from Experimental Farm Network, I think is the place selling that. I think that's right. Which is Puerto Cortez is it's a Central American tomato. You know, and why not? Because where are tomatoes from? They're from Northern South America and Central America. You know, don't go to Germany to get your tomatoes. Go to where tomatoes come from. Particularly if our climate's more like theirs, which it is. Puerto Cortez is really good. The other one is Santiago, which is another Central American tomato, which I have been very excited about. They're both really good. Neither one of them are giant tomatoes. Neither one of them are really cherry tomatoes. They're kind of intermediate, and they're really very good. And they're all those varieties I tried, Réunion Rippled, which is a great Caribbean tomato, it's good. They're all very good. None of them produced as abundantly, as consistently, or has had a great flavor. Santiago is a variety that I got from, dadgummit, it's Tomato Fest out in California. I get them where I can. I look for where they're from, and then I go where I have to get them to buy them. I got the seeds from Tomato Fest. They've got, I think that's where Santiago's from. And I think Experimental Farm Network, which is up on the Hudson Valley, of all places, have been exploring these Central American tomatoes. We ought to be doing that ourselves, but we don't. We depend on other people to do it for us, and we get lucky every now and then, and they'll bring to Puerto Cortez and Santiago. Incredible, and been very successful. Puerto Cortez can produce all year long, even in Mobile. I think it'll kind of survive the many years it will survive that midsummer July funk that I say kills all tomatoes. But I have seen Puerto Cortez survive it and come back in fall and produce more tomatoes. It's a really an incredible little tomato. I really like it. Is it too late to sow ornamental gourds? No, probably not. The one thing you have to get around the pests It's just a big thing. But I think there is a day length issue. I don't think that's going to affect gourds, though. I think you'll be okay. Go ahead and give it a shot. You might have some bug problems. Jim, you know, I always love hearing about the Chickasaw hay. Yeah, and it's interesting. So, Jim, I don't remember. So, you know, I'm a Chickasaw hay native. I was born on the Chickasaw hay. Actually, I wasn't born on the Chickasaw hay. I was born in the hospital in Meridian. But we lived on the Chickasaw hay, a little north of Greene County. And I don't remember, honestly, what, at 4 years old, I was calling chiggers. Chiggers, red bugs, I don't know. Jim says they're red bugs on the Chickasaw hay, and sulfur dusting on the boots is what he remembered. I think it works. I think it works pretty well. I think it works pretty, pretty well. Pictures of mushrooms growing in a pot, in a container. This is an interesting story. These are, oh, goodness gracious, Leuco something or another. It's the yellow mushroom that grows up in pots, yellow parasol mushrooms, let's call it. And you see them a lot in containers. They're actually tropical mushrooms. We have spread them around the globe through greenhouses and other things. When I see that in a container, I don't worry about the mushroom itself causing problems. It's not. It probably, that mushroom came from the greenhouse where you bought the plant. Okay? The spores or the mycelia for the mushroom, not the flower itself. What you're looking at now is the mushroom flowering. It's mushroom fanatics would kill me for saying it's a flower, but it is essentially, you can think of it as a flower. It's the spore producing, it's the reproductive organ of the mushroom, equivalent to a flower. The mushroom's been in that soil doing all of its work for a long time, and it was brought to you from the greenhouse where you bought that plant. Now, it's not too big a deal because it's saprophytic. It lives off dead matter. Sapro, I think, means something like dead, and phytic means I like it. And it eats dead matter. So all of that organic matter in the soil, it's eating up. It's not eating the plant at all. It is leading to compaction of the soil eventually, but that's not the big problem. The thing you have to worry about most is that when you get a lot of mushrooms growing in your pot, the soil itself may be very wet. Ah, and that ain't good for your plant. And I'm, you know, it's, what is that, a New Guinea impatiens I'm seeing growing in the pot? So New Guineas have a lot of issues, right? They don't like our heat as much. They don't like our midsummer conditions as much as some of the older impatiens do, but they are resistant to some of the diseases that the older impatiens do. But and they're pretty. So New Guinea impatiens are going through their midsummer funk. They're not looking good, but it also looks like the soil itself may be a little bit wet. So wetter than it should be, and it's because it's raining a lot. But that may mean you need to change the soil out. So we'll talk about that. You can call me and talk about when that soil, yeah. Here we go. We're going to take a break.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Lots of cool questions, which I'm thinking about. Clay has sent me beautiful pictures of Santiago's grown in his backyard. Santiago tomatoes. Ellen. I recommend them. They're really good. They're really great. And Ellen, we talked about how you're going to need to deal with your tomatoes next year. You call me back and let's figure that one out. But I recommend you include Santiago in your list. And Santiago is pretty easy to find. Where did I say? Tomato Fest. Wasn't that right? Somebody always reminds me. Is it CB or somebody always calls to remind me? About where I get Santiago's from, but I think it's Tomato Fest. There are a couple of Santiago's out there. You know, like there's nobody out there. There's no name police out there. unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know which. And so people can name tomatoes whatever they like to name them and publish a catalog with that name in there. Santiago, so I've seen a couple or three Santiagos. These are the Santiagos from Tomato Fest, Ellen. Yeah, there they are. There they are. And I got a smile. That's very nice. Thank you. Is it too late to sow Brussels and broccoli on the windowsill? No. In fact, next week, after I got through my chigger thing this week, I'm going to come back to chiggers here in just a minute. After I got through with my chigger thing this week, next week was going to be, yeah, we got to start. No, I think this is the right time. I think for the Gulf Coast, it's just about the right time. Next week is probably just about the right time to start thinking about that. Brussels sprouts. Yeah, I ain't making no guarantees about Brussels sprouts. I have, for northern Alabama, they seem to do better. I don't know. My dad did real well in the Black Belt with Brussels sprouts. I don't know how he did it, but he did. And so I am telling you, it's possible to do real well with Brussels sprouts. I have tried Brussels sprouts in several places, and here's my impression. They are a lot of work. And I'm not sure I think the work is worth it, given what you pick off of them. And it is very difficult to make them head up properly on the Gulf Coast. I just could not do it. And I did it not because I thought I needed to for myself, but because, you know, I sacrifice for the good of the community. And so I'm going to try to grow Brussels sprouts, dadgummit. And I just couldn't do it. But somebody who's really grown Brussels sprouts well on the Gulf should talk about it. They don't head up. You got to plant them at just the right time. And it could be tricky. I'm not making no guarantees. Broccoli, on the other hand, you get the right varieties of broccoli, it's great. And you know what? Here's the cool thing about broccoli. You actually get to harvest a bunch of it. I mean, like Brussels sprouts, you think, oh, man, I actually got 5 Brussels sprouts. I can cook them. Broccoli, you can just keep harvesting and harvesting and harvesting. Nice, but it's good. We'll talk about that next week. It's coming on. Not too late at all. Not too late at all. Now, the pumpkins and the vine borer, I want to talk about that, really. Let's take a minute to talk about pumpkins and vine borers. Because we've had several questions about pumpkins. There are some pumpkins that are going to be very difficult to grow in areas like South Alabama, where vine borers are prolific. I mean, they start early and they continue. It may be that in fall they decline just a little bit, actually. I think maybe they do, but the fact of the matter is they're still going to be pretty prolific. So your best bet is to look for squash that are resistant to the vine borer. And boy, Heidi, are there ever. Abby, is that you? Yeah. There are so many. So you got this Jarhadale, I don't know how they pronounce it. And I suspect you got it from Baker Creek. Am I right? Yeah, you probably got it from Baker Creek. And Baker Creek's a catalog. They sell lots of squash. Now I want you to go look on the squash page at Baker Creek. Because that's what I'm doing right now. And because I want to see all the different varieties they have. And they have incredible varieties of squash. I want you to go through that list. And I want you to look at all of the squash that have the name C.Moscata attached. Moscata, M-O-S-C-H-A-T-A. Moscata, I don't know. How you pronounce it how you want to. Moscata, it's a species. And you'll look right there and you see the honey nut butternut squash, the burpees butternut butter squash, butternuts, butterbush butternut squash. They're all C. Moscata. There's the butternut orange squash. There is the Yuzhijiang Binghua squash, which is apparently a butternut squash. There is, oh, let's go down through here. Let's look at, there is the butternut Rugosa Violona. I don't know. There's too many languages here. It's an Italian butternut squash. It's just absolutely beautiful. They're all Moscata. There's a ton of them. And, you know, you could even get one that looks nearly as ugly as that one you got from Australia. It's beautifully ugly. It's black futsu squash. Black futsu squash, I'm pretty sure it is Moscata. Look at that one. All of those Moscata squashes. It is. It's Moscata. All of those Moscata squashes are pretty resistant to vine borers, and that's because they have solid stems. So don't feel like because you can't grow some of the pumpkins that they grow in Boston where they don't have squash vine borers. Boston is a lovely place. It's a lovely place. It's a great place. It's a beautiful place. But we ain't in Boston. We're in Alabama, and we don't grow the same things they grow, and we should be quit taking advice from them, and we should quit trying to grow their vegetables. We ought to grow our vegetables, and Moscata is the squash that we grow very well. There's lots of them, lots of varieties. So look for those, and you won't have the problems with the squash vine borers. I won't say you will never have a problem. Yeah, you got it. There you go. You got the Moscata. Yeah, so there it is. So Abby actually got the right Moscata. Butternut Rugosa Violona. Pronounce that's way too many vowels in one place. Abby, you said it to me. You got to pronounce it. Joie? I don't know. Joie? I don't know. There's just way, I mean, four vowels in sequence? I don't know what to do about that. Yeah, it's a good Italian squash. And there it is. And then you could do like David does and grow melaton. But we can do lots of things. But Moscata in the squashes is the one we do best. And that's what we do great. And why not, you know, don't mess with it. All right, what else we got? We're going to be back here to deal with it in just a minute.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, let's get back to it. So we've got some interesting questions. Wayne has been pushing me to answer this question for 2 weeks. And I keep looking at this photograph that he sent in of a grass, and it's a very interesting looking grass. I'm very hopeful about it. And I'm looking for the right information, which sometimes is down in the ligules, which is where the leaf comes off of the stalk, or sometimes it's at the base of the stalk, which can tell me a lot by the color and the fatness of the base of the stalk. But most of all, I can really tell you what a grass is by looking at the flowering head, which this one's about to do, Wayne. I can see it coming on. And once that flower head comes up, ooh, I bet you I can tell you exactly what it is. Right now, I ain't sure because I don't have enough information in this picture to do it, but it's an interesting one. Looks like it could be a native. I'm even hopeful it could be gamma grass, Tripsicum, which is a beautiful native, but I'm not sure about it. I'm not sure about it. I can't tell from here. I got to look at that ligule. It could be sugarcane plume grass, which is another great native, which is wonderful. You're going to know pretty soon. We're going to see because I can see those stalks for the flower heads beginning to arise. So, Wayne, if you don't mind, don't put me on the spot yet, because that's hard. I'm sure there are some people who could look at a piece of grass and just say, just based on a diffuse picture of a leaf, what it is. And sometimes I can, but in this case I can't. It could even be Johnson grass, which is not such a great thing. But I don't think it is. I think it's a native. Let's let it flower. And once the flower comes out and I have a better sense of scale and other things, I can tell you what it is. It could be purple top. There's another thought that I had. But I don't think it is. I don't think that's quite right place for it. But, Wayne, just give take me another picture when that flower stalk comes out. And you'll see the flower stalk come up. That's a flower that it's putting up. And you'll the little flowers will form some kind of head that could be really showy if it's sugarcane plume grass. It could be really odd if it's gamma grass. It's going to look like a very bizarre primitive corn, which is what gamma grass is related to. But we'll look at the flower head and kind of figure it out. But give me a little more information. Let's let that plant come on just a little bit more. A little bit more. My friend David has mentioned that Baker Creek is a great road trip. I have not been there, but I've seen pictures of the grounds. They certainly have an elaborate setup there. And it's really, really an interesting place. You got to go to Missouri to do it. Somewhere out in Missouri is where they are, and near Branson maybe, but it's a cool visit, and the catalog is good. Baker Creek is a great place. Rareseeds.com, I think, is what their internet address is. Baker Creek, they've got a lot of things in their catalog if you've never explored it, and it's a great place to get. It's not the gospel. It's not the gospel. Some of the stuff that they sell is not going to do well for you. You can call me and we can talk about it. And I don't have a comprehensive knowledge of all of their plants and how well they'll do, but I have some sense. So you can look through the catalog, and next week you can call me back and you can ask me, what do you think about this? And I'll say, I don't know. I think it could work. Or I might say, yeah, I've tried it. It doesn't work. And you can take that for what it's worth, because you can do things that I don't do. But there it is. Baker Creek. Good place. Good place. Will azaleas and hydrangeas grow in the stand? Will the paintbrush blue stem choke it all out? So, interesting question. Jason sent me a question about paintbrush blue stem. Have you got paintbrush blue stem there, Jason, or did you just read me yammering about it? Here's what I think about paintbrush blue stem. When you go towards a grassy environment like paintbrush blue stem, you want to keep that separate from your azaleas and hydrangeas. It's a very different thing. It's a meadow. It's not a shrubland, and it's going to be very difficult to keep it as a shrub tree land. You're going to want to keep it as a meadow where you've got grasses and wildflowers. So I don't see, at least in a small area, combining paintbrush blue stem with azaleas and hydrangeas. I would use them elsewhere. Azaleas and hydrangeas can survive in that sand. It can be hard on everybody, and there's some special preparations you need to do for sand. And one of the problems with sand is it compacts and gets really dense. I know you don't believe that. It's not loose. It doesn't even drain well sometimes. It either drains too well or not at all, depending on how you've treated it. And if you've just built a house there, it probably doesn't drain well at all. But you need to add organic matter and lots of it to that if you're going to grow shrubs there. And there's some simple ways of doing that. We can talk about it. So if you decide you want to do azaleas or hydrangeas, let's talk about that. We'll set you up for that. And you're probably going to need to water a little bit more with those. And you probably want a little bit of shade, not a lot, just a little bit of midday shade in particular. And I can see you're developing some midday shade there. We can talk about how to do that. You call me. We'll talk about it sometime. For the azaleas and hydrangeas. And there's no reason you can't do both, azaleas and hydrangeas and paintbrush blue stem meadows. Boy, I talked about paintbrush blue stem a lot in my column today, didn't I? It's a cool thing. I love it. It's a cool grass. and beautiful grass. And so are the wildflowers that you can grow with it. But put them in a separate area from the shrubs, because you have to manage them differently. And they're going to like different degrees of sunlight, too. The paintbrush blue stem and the meadow, it's about full sunlight. Mm-hmm. And it's about dealing with drought conditions. So you got a droughty place, you got a tough place for shrubs. It's a great place. Great place. Now, the giant hole with sphagnum moss and potting soil. Oh, man. You're going to put me and your mom at odds. And that is not a good thing, Jason. Jason says, Mom would dig a giant hole with sphagnum moss and potting soil. So let me tell you, I used to take that advice too, because I heard it from somebody who heard it from somebody else who heard it from somebody else when I was just getting started. And I noticed that it was creating lots of problems. And I thought, well, I'm doing everything right. I'm digging a big hole. I'm putting sphagnum in there. I've gotten all this stuff. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of research that shows that is not the thing to do, and that it actually causes rot. Now, listen, don't you put me between you and your mom, Jason. You keep this to yourself. That what your mom does is what your mom does. She can call me separately, and we can have, but don't you go to her and tell her this. But I'm going to tell you, don't do that. You're going to create a bathtub, particularly in that sandy soil. And I can go into all the gory details about why this happens. And if you want me to, I will. But I don't want to right now unless you demand it. You're going to have huge drainage problems if you do that. What we know now is that you need to use the native soil, no matter what that native soil is, and break it up as far around the plant as you can. Go out, and not a tiller. You don't need a tiller. Just take a fork. Break it up in a diameter around, say, 6 feet around the plant, if you're planting an azalea, or a whole bit. Just break it up. Just crack it. Don't turn it. You don't want to turn it. You're going to create all kinds of problems. And then put the amendments, and then plant your plants, okay? Plant them. Don't plant them any deeper than you actually want them to sit above the soil surface just a little bit, okay? Listen to me. They're going to sit above the soil surface just a little bit in the native soil. Whatever that native soil is, it doesn't matter. And they will sit about, let's say, an inch or two above the soil surface. And particularly in that area, I think that's a good idea. Then come back with your amendment. Sphagnum's a bad idea. Oh, God, your mom is going to kill me. Sphagnum is the worst amendment because it turns to dust in this environment. It is gone. It is gone within weeks. What you really want to use is pine bark. I talk about it a lot, and it's pine bark about the size of your thumb. It's kind of what we found, and it works really well. You could use other things. You could have lots of leaf mold. It'll last a while. You can do all that detritus in there, but peat moss is not the thing at all, period. And do not put it in a hole. You want it on the surface. And you know why it's on the surface? Here's the other thing. Here's the great discovery. This is the amazing thing. You know why topsoil is called topsoil? Ooh! What a discovery! The good soil's on the top. Always on the top. That's where you need it the most. You don't need it down in the bottom of the hole. That creates problems. You need the good stuff on the surface. Call me back. We'll talk about why. All right. Let's see what else we got. There's the firecracker plant. I'll talk a little bit about that. And I'll come back with the Latin name just so it'll be easier to find. Give me just a second because it's escaping my head right now, Barry, but I'm going to tell you. Let's see who else we've got here. What did Jim say? Jim's talking about growing your own pineapples. It does take a lot of patience. And I need to look up how commercial pineapple operations actually get all their pineapples. I'm sure they got a system for it. I think I know what they do. But we'll talk about that when we come back. I'm gonna look it up real quick. And we got 30 seconds. How much time we got? We got 15 minutes. I hope I'm getting everybody's questions answered. There's one more question, though, that somebody sent me a picture of their yard. And because I know it was a continuation of last week's show. And I want to know what it is that you wanted to do there. Let's see. I'll look for that in just a minute. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Charlie, you could have just held that off. You know, you could have just held that for 15 more minutes. What a bad guy Charlie is. No, he's a great guy. Tiny Tim. Listen, so let's get back to these questions we've got. You know, you try to remember names right off the top of your head. And somebody sent me a picture of a plant that they got at the big box store, got lots of red flowers all over it. And I remembered the common name that is the useless common name, firecracker plant, which is, it's usually, I don't remember the common name. I did in this case. It seems to be the common name that's used. It's firecracker plant is, this is an important thing. Firecracker plant is one of those Joe Billy names. You know, Dad had horses. They were Smokey Joe. They were Joe Billy. I can't even remember which horse was which, because they were all Smokey Joe or Joe Billy, right? Lord have mercy. We got to find, you know, we were charged with finding names for things. Ain't nobody, it's our responsibility. We have a terrible habit doing it. So firecracker plants is a name that's attached to a lot of plants. So it gets kind of useless. You could look it up and it would be, oh, well, it doesn't look like that firecracker plant. Well, it's not that firecracker plant. I have to give you the Latin name, and I did give it to Jason. It's Russellia equisetiformis, which is kind of interesting. Russellia is meaning this other than the fact that it was named for some guy named Russell. I have no idea who he was. That's the genus, but the Latin name's kind of interesting. Equisetiformis, which means like a horse. And in this case, like a horse's tail. It kind of looks like a horse's tail with all that green foliage. And then those red plants. It's got a name of coral plant, but of course there are 15 gajillion plants with the name coral plant. But Russellia equisetiformis, Jason, is what you got. You can look it up. There it is. There's Barry. Excuse me, not Jason, Barry. Jason and I'm just trying to stay out of trouble with Jason's mom. I don't want to be in trouble with anybody's mom. That's, you know, that has been a philosophy of mine since I was 12 years old. And it has stood me well. I've not always been successful, but it is a background philosophy. Don't be in trouble with anybody's mom. What else we got? Let's see. Who else have we got? There were some pictures that were sent in to me and from a yard. I think the idea was that we were going to look at a picture of the yard and I was going to see, is it good for wildflowers? And one of the things I did in today's column, and we can talk about this more next week. I want to talk about a lot of things next week, but in today's column in the newspaper, there's this thing called a newspaper. It's ink on paper. You probably don't remember seeing that before. But a lot of you, that's new. But there's still some ink and paper things going on out there. And it's called a newspaper, and I got a column in it. And one of the things I talked about was the importance of grasses, how important the native grasses are. And next week, the column will be about how important native grasses are for wildflowers. You can't really have wildflowers without native grasses, at least on a sustaining level. And you can grow wildflowers as if they were peonies or pansies or whatever else, petunias. And there is much trouble. But if you want them to grow wild, they really have to companion with grasses. And so one of the things we have to do there, I think if what I'm understanding we're trying to do in this yard is to get wildflowers there, the first thing we got to do is make sure we got the right base. One of the grasses that I see there is Kogon grass, I'm pretty sure. Kogon grass is a terrible invasive. It makes life hard for everybody. I can't fix it. It's something we brought. It's a plague we brought on ourselves. And it makes decision making a little bit harder. But the first stage in dealing with Kogon grass, besides recognizing it and learning to get rid of it, and we can talk about that next week. Gonna not have time today, but you call me back next week, we'll talk about it. Is using broom sage, the good old broom sage. And I think you may have some broom sage in there along with some purple top and some other things. So we're going to talk about that next week. Meanwhile, would you do me a favor, do some homework. Why don't you look up broom sage? Broom sage. It's the classic old grass of the South. And when you see it, particularly of old fields, it's the old field native blue stem. It is so good for so many things. It is our way to heal ourselves out of so many problems in our landscape. It's a great healer. And it is probably the only thing you're going to be able to use that deals with that Kogon grass well. So we're going to try to get there first. And then you call me next week and let's talk a little bit about what it is we're trying to do there, what you want it, what's your ultimate vision of how you want that landscape to look, and we'll think about it. We do have an obstacle, which is Kogon grass. We're going to have to think about that and figure out how to get around it. And it's going to be a problem no matter what you do there. It will be a problem no matter what you do there. Yes, so listen, there were some folks who, I won't say who said this, but speaking of being in good graces with somebody's mom, I'm going to agree with this mom. Somebody wanted her to prune her magnolias up from the bottom so that you can mow underneath it. What? Can we laugh at that? Can we just laugh at that whole idea? And you know what? We have a very wise mom. She said, God knows what magnolias are supposed to look like. And she hit it on the head. Folks, if you ever plant a magnolia and you prune off those bottom branches, you have just made yourself miserable for life. I'm telling you, it's just the wrong idea. I don't know. You don't want to mow under a magnolia because there won't be nothing to mow. You want that magnolia to have limbs to the ground. That is when magnolias are beautiful. It's when you can see the flowers. You know, people say, well, you know, I'm supposed to be able to look at the flowers on this magnolia, but they're way up in the tree. Yeah, don't prune those bottom branches. You want magnolias to be a cone. You want them to be, for lack of a better term, a Christmas tree. You don't want to cut those lower branches. The person who sent me that message, you tell your mom, man, she knows what she's talking about. She knows. Yeah, see, I'm going to stay on mama's good side. She knows what she's talking about. Anna asked me about kiwis, and kiwis are a thing. I think Jason has them up at Petals of the Past. And I will check on that, and we'll see if you can get them up at Petals of the Past. I'll have to check on it. That's up towards Birmingham. I don't know whether any local folks have the AU varieties or not. There's a reason Jason does, but I'll check on that between now and next week. I have 15 seconds to tell you, chiggers make it real. Chiggers make it real. If you haven't experienced chiggers, you probably are not in touch with reality. That's my thought. Hey, we'll be back next week. It's good talking to you.